brick smiles like lightning to my soul. Should've known that she was making witchcraft. Should've known that she would steal my soul. She asked me for a dance, then she cast her tantrum. Moves and whispers like a siren sent from hell. She told me where her room was and she beckoned me to go. Her body heat washed over me like a steaming lava flow. I should have known that she was making witchcraft.
Listen to us.
Night Dreams Talk Radio, After Dark, wants to give a big shout out to all the truckers that listen to our show.
We're here to make you feel
Hi, Tom Davis here with Metatron Power and Light. We'd like to thank everyone for all the positive emails and responses to our music. Our music can be found on Amazon, Spotify, YouTube, and all digital outlets, and is featured on Night Dreams Talk Radio with Gary Anderson.
Metatron Power and Light is a band that deals with esoteric subjects, the paranormal, and other topics that engage the spirit and mind. Visit MetatronPowerAndLight.com to learn more.
We are facing a time of great change and the future is unwritten. But when we come together and seek answers, we expand our awareness until we begin to see the unseen. Uncovering secrets allows us to develop the knowledge we will need to shape our future and control our destiny.
The views, opinions, and representations expressed on the Night Dreams Talk Radio Network and its website are those of the hosts, guests, and participants, and are not necessarily those of or endorsed by the network, its affiliated stations and broadcasts, the management, other hosts, or advertisers of the network. The shows found on the Night Dreams Talk Radio Network can, but do not necessarily, promote any particular lifestyle, belief, religion, political affiliation, or other personal practice. These shows are for entertainment purposes only and are not intended to treat, diagnose, and or claim any cure of disease or condition or give any medical or legal advice. Coming to you from some far point station, like a cosmic tumbleweed, both north and south of the Pleiades, here's your host, Gary Anderson.
Well, good evening or morning, depending on your time zone. You're listening to Night Dreams Talk Radio, brought to you by Night Dreams Talk Radio Network. Well, tonight we got a great show. We got Ed Roman, who is award-winning singer, songwriter, performer. He's out of British Columbia. We're going to be talking about mammoths and Greek mythology here tonight. And let's bring him on right now. Ed, it's been a long time since you've been on the show. How have you been, my friend?
All right, my friend. I'm like everybody else, you know, doing what I need to do to stay alive and stay happy and functioning. And I just got to say, it's good to be here because this is a fun topic and we're going to have some fun talking about this stuff tonight.
Well, out of curiosity, in your country, how are they treating this virus? You know, here, I'm in Washington State. They keep going back a level because, you know, they start, you know, saying, well, now you can go to restaurants again. You can go out and meet with, you know, people. But then they scaled it back because every time they do it, the virus starts picking up. How is it at in your country?
Pretty much the same in regards to, like, the fluctuation will then usher in a new level lockdown. So we're in a 6-week lockdown. We're coming close to the end of that. But again, it was like you could go into restaurants, you could in-store shop. Now it's curbside pickup only delivery. And it seems to reflect like that, again, the rise or flux of whatever may be going on. But I mean, as much as people are frustrated with everything, I think it's, you know, the decision-making processes of certain things are what's crucial. I mean, I've been looking at numbers in New Zealand and their practices in terms of what they did and how they went about, you know, basically shutting down the country and through a 6-week, you know, diagnosis of what was going on and a comprehensive lockdown. Very little as far as what I know, as far as people being infected or dying. And they don't have that same critical mass that we're experiencing right now. So I think that's like everybody. It seems to be that way. Like you guys down there, I've talked to other people in other states and like, yeah, we're kind of similar to what you guys are doing. So it's tough. It's tough.
Yeah, it is. Of course, you know, we could be like North Korea, you know, who has been admitting they don't have the virus. But you know what they do? If someone has the virus, they take care of it instantly. They take you up against a brick wall and shoot you. That's how they take care of it there.
Well, I mean, and this is the thing. I think that it's interesting to have a mom, you know, that's an octogenarian and to get this sort of perspective of time, you know, living through polio herself, people in her family being affected by polio, tuberculosis. You know, my dad had one of the flu outbreaks in the early 1950s affect him. The outcome of what all this represents is an incredible amount of change and things where you just go, well, I mean, the world economy has shut down, the amount of bailouts and things that are related to like how we pay this back at some point or who do we pay back, like the arguments that ensue between not just like the average person on the street depending on their opinions, but like families and friends that have become divided in their opinions about it. It's been a sociological battle in terms of, you know, interpretation of it all. And I think that that's what's more of what this is about, is like, let's look at all the information critically and so that we can better inform ourselves and at the same time better understand what's going on. I've heard everybody from, you know, biologists that are like, you know, evolutionary biologists and people that are doctors, people that work for the WHO, asking for this kind of data so that they can better understand what it is. And again, we're left with that, wait a minute, I still kind of don't know, but I'm making my decisions because of critical mass. And sometimes that's not the best way to make a decision. So, and that can be synonymous with a lot of things in terms of how we approach it and how we interact with it. So it's crazy.
It is. And you know what really concerns me here, and then we'll get on your subject here for tonight, is all the homeless people. It's gone up high. And what I'm worried about in our country, I know in our state that in August, well, they're going to start the foreclosure process, the eviction process. And people don't have money saved to go move into another place. It's going to be horrid. And our economy is, you know, not doing well. You know, people just got their money. They went out and paid bills or, you know, did whatever they could do with a little bit of money they have. Now they're talking about again going to maybe come out with a fourth check, you know, right, to tie people over, because they realized, you know, $1,400 a person isn't going to pay their bills off. It isn't even going to pay an average person one month's rent.
No. And that's true. And even on the simple math, I mean, here in Canada, the first bailout was $82 billion. So there's 37 million Canadians. So you divide 37 million into 82 billion, and it works out to be 2.246 million per Canadian. But that's not what occurred. And there's been other factions of those bailouts through different organizations in the country for, you know, helping citizens with what's going on. But again, that is, again, a bigger topic and question to say, well, where does that money come from? What is backing that money? How do we then circumnavigate out of this? Because it's one thing to go back to our jobs, but then how do we pay off an incredibly huge debt that's related to it all? And it's confusing. It confuses a lot of people, especially when you've just sort of been living comfortably within that framework for so long, and all of a sudden the proverbial carpet is pulled out from beneath your feet. I've seen stuff that's going on in LA and people living on the streets, in tents, like, you know, they've even changed certain things with bylaws, from what I understand. So instead of, you know, the police being able to come and take all your stuff, that's a new bylaw where they're not allowed to do that, so that you can have your stuff there. So, I mean, what are all people supposed to do? I mean, set up a tent. I was evicted. Here's some of my furniture, my personal items, and I'm living on, you know, what street with like hundreds of other people. You're right. It's crazy. And bigger questions need to be asked, you know, about that. And then you have, as I mentioned, aside from all of this, a credible amount of levels of social divide in terms of so many different things. There needs to be a unificator, you know, that comes from a point of simplicity, because that's what needs to fix the problem. More things are not going to fix the problem. More money being handed out, as you mentioned, the fourth check. I mean, how far can we go with what all that represents?
Now, that's the part, you know. Again, you know, I had somebody tell me one day, you know what, my landlord said, soon as August comes around, they're going to evict me. And I said, well, have you paid any rent? No, not for the past year. Well, I said, well, look, your landlord is paying mortgage on where you're staying at. Where is he coming up with the money from? No one's helping him. So, a two-way street. I know you're a very famous person in Canada with your folk music and stuff like that. I know it has to be affecting you. You're not out performing like you normally have been. I know my show is taking a big hit because sponsors, they don't want to spend the money right now because they don't have it. So it's affecting everybody. It really is.
Every part of, even like with kids, I mean, the psychology of it, you know, I mean, what it now represents to do anything basic, from going for a drive somewhere to get groceries to, you know, what happens at school. There's now this envelope of now all this has to happen. It changes the way that the mind opens to certain things, because it's always on the fight or flight version of what we're supposed to be thinking about. And it's sometimes really hard to ingest information properly when you're predicated on fear. Everything that you're doing is based on fear. So it has affected every aspect of what is going on the globe. It's wild. I mean, I'm fortunate with, like, I'm shoestringing my life with a budget and living sometimes week to week or day to day, depending on what's going on. And I'm fortunate that I still have some licensing going on, which means that I don't have the gig, but I'm still getting some money coming in from the fact that I'm doing that. But as I mentioned, like 6 months of the year that are coming in front of me is gardening and growing food. And that literally saves me thousands of dollars every year because I don't have to buy it somewhere. I guess that's what, like, I have that fortunate ability, as I mentioned, of having 2 feet still in two worlds of thinking about it. But I'm always trying through my process of what I do to empower other people with it, that they're capable of doing the same things, especially when it comes, I said, growing food. Kids are a great place to start, man, because they're sponges and excited to be tactical with their hands, and they want to know how something works. And, you know, adults become very conditioned in the process, and it's like, well, I can buy that at the store. Well, yeah. Of course, we can all buy that at the store. But knowing that you can changes your response to what it is, and your appreciation level goes through the roof because you understand it can take trial, error, failure. Sometimes there's good years, sometimes there isn't. You have to be continually asking your garden what it wants of you in order for it to sustain you at some point. People don't want to go through that. That I understand why. In some cases, they may think it's drudgery, but it can be a part of your lifestyle if you do it right.
Oh, yeah. And you know what? If anything ever happened, like we talked about before on the air, if our grid system went down, you know how many people would perish because they don't know how to defend for themselves. They don't know how to grow a garden. They don't know how to be self-sustaining. People don't even know how to harvest water. Safe drinking water if something happened. That's the scary part.
Look what happened in Texas with the bit of snow and the things that were happening. I mean, just to even have a generator, you know, so you can run your furnace so your pipes don't freeze, or you can run your pump and your well. I years ago bought one. I mean, I bought it for live gigs, for when we were outside playing and doing things, but I kept it, and if the power goes out, I use it. But again, there's, you know, people all around me that probably don't have a generator, and what do they do? You know, and it can be, you know, again, how do you prepare? We live in a very thin veneer of security in terms of so many things, and I guess that's why it's healthy to have conversations about it, because it sort of gives you that sense of realization, like, well, hey, you know what? Maybe I should think about that. I don't talk about it to scare people. Like, people are like, wow, that sounds like you're a prepper or something. It's like, no, I come from multiple generations of family farms and people that farmed, and it was always a part of our lifestyle. So that's where it comes from. It has more to do with that and feeling the realization and being able to share it with somebody and go, well, try it, give it a shot. And when it has happened for some people, and I get like a little message and like, hey, my tomatoes in my backyard are getting bigger, and I'm going to, you know, what should I do next? And I can see how excited they are about it. And in no time at all, you know, they're like, I can't wait to do this next year, right? Like, so, like everything, you grow with it.
And it saves you money. I'll say this, and then we'll get into talking about mammoths and stuff. Like, you know, my daughter, you know, she called me up. She lives in Hemet, California. She called us up the other day. She goes, we bought a new car. And I go, what did you buy? And she goes, well, we got a battery-operated car, you know, rechargeable car. I'm not going to mention the name. And, you know, I hesitated for a second. Then I said, you know, you did the right thing, because like a couple days before she told us she bought a new car, I was reading about what it costs an average person in, like, Washington State or L.A., for gas a year, going to work and back, and then doing a little traveling, going to the store. The average people dump in about $7,000 to $8,000 a year for gas in their vehicle. A lot of people don't realize it because they're paying for it all the time. Now, electric car runs about $1,300 to $1,400 a year for electricity to charge it. It's a no-brainer. Look how much money you save.
I know, and that's the thing. I mean, your point is so well taken about the aging grids, or how, you know, we move things from A to B, whether it be electricity or commodities. There are so many new advancements in new, as you mentioned, the electric car has been around for a while and has been struggling to be what it is today, and it'll grow even more. But that's what we need to figure out. What is still from the past that is not antiquated, we need to still think about it and engage with. But what is needs updating, like, huge. And an electric car, I mean, I would like to get one of those. I have to confess.
Well, they're fast, too. A lot of people don't realize it. They have come a long way. So if you want to burn rubber, the electric cars, like the Tesla, will do it. I mean, you know, let's face it. Now, to get into the subject we're supposed to be talking, see, that's the problem. When I get my mouth going, it doesn't quit. It's like the ever-ready battery.
You're fun, Gary, and you like to, like, you know, it's like an improv solo on the saxophone. You just don't know where it's going to go.
That's right. Well, we're going to be talking about mammoths, prehistoric time on Earth. So I'm going to let you, you know, start it, and then we'll go with the flow.
Well, I guess where I should start is, like, you know, I got turned on to the whole topic of cosmographia, which is sort of the study of the three major disciplines, which is astronomy, geology, and mathematics. And a lot of the work that I've fallen in love with and follow and I consider a mentor is a gentleman named Randall Carlson from the United States. And he's originally from Michigan area, but he lives down in Georgia now. And he spent, 45 years of his life studying a good portion of this material. But a lot of the material he is talking about is reinvigorated through a lot of new people that have talked about what the sort of landscapes of catastrophe represent. And in the past, people like Velikovsky and Sedgwick were sort of grandfathers and what you would consider the yesteryear's catastrophists. These were people that went out into the landscapes of the United States, especially, and in different parts of the world, Russia, and started to realize that something of a greater magnitude had occurred here. And where this sort of realization comes from in terms of mathematics and studying mathematics is a concept which is known as scale invariance, which means that mathematically you can kind of look at concepts and you'll see their variance in ratios on macroscopic levels and microscopic levels, big levels and tiny levels. So an easiest way to think about it is like, let's say there's been a rainstorm and you're, kind of walking along the side of the road and you see that there's been a washout, and you start to look at the washout from the amount of rain that's flooded through the area. And you, if you could shrink yourself down, the sort of, fingerings that have been carved into the sand and rock and maybe a puddle or like a large channel that's been carved into the ditch is the byproduct of this heavy amount of water that's been moving. And the idea of scale invariance works very similar, that when you now, today we have the fortunate ability to have satellites and look at this beautiful globe from a distance and look at things in a certain way that we never had the perspective before. But back then, those kinds of people were looking and saying, like, well, what I'm seeing here actually is the byproduct of catastrophic water erosion and events that could not be attributed to something which today we would say is the gradualistic method, which you would find, in universities, which are basically saying we can extrapolate what we see today and move backwards to be able to understand the past. But in some cases, that may not always be the case. And of course, gradualism is a good way to look at certain things, even with the concept of Darwinism in certain things. But there are also certain things to be questioning about that as well. So with that said, the idea that, these guys were kind of, because gradualism meets this new sort of or old way of thinking about looking at stuff, they were kind of labeled as biblical literalists. And neoliteralists that were like sort of reviving the idea that, well, they're talking about Noah's flood, and we've learned so much more than that. And that's really just myth and, part of whatever it might be. But, just to sort of say on that topic that is probably on an anthropological level, the myth legend of the flood is synonymous with practically every culture around the world in some aspect. And I can't remember the name of the gentleman again. He was a painter, and he was really infatuated with, Aboriginal cultures in the United States. So he traveled a good portion of his life moving from group to group, Arapaho, Navajo, Cherokee, Ojibwe, whatever it was, that he was always connecting, painting, learning from them, understanding their culture, hearing their stories. And in his sort of preface of his book, of his illustrations and paintings, one of the things that he had said was, I was fascinated by the fact that these cultures were so diverse. They had so many different things, and that were separate from each other, which were language, concepts in food, clothing, art, their own personal, colloquialistic stories that would be related to the areas as they grew up because of, anything from hunting to whatever it might be. But one thing that they all shared in common was this story of this epic moment of a flood. And they all have their version of how and what occurred at that moment in time. So back to sort of people like Sedgwick and Velikovsky that, now we move into the future and people are kind of like revisiting this information inside of the dialogue of this new environment of thinking about stuff like the gradualistic theory. So they start realizing, well, wait a minute. You know, there is this scale to what we're seeing that we need to ask more questions about. And coincidentally, right around the same time, which was known as sort of the Clovis people and the Clovisites that were part of, you know, the early Four Points people that you would consider the borderline between Pleistocene and Holocene people, you know, and they were in the millions in the United States, that at these archaeological sites where they were finding debris from these people, not the people, the actual, like, you know, arrowheads or whatever it was that they were using, they found this black mat layer. And I know you had mentioned, you know, the Jurassic and Triassic period and the Tertiary periods and, you know, what was that part and parcel of a major extinction. Well, this black mat layer, like the iridium layer that's all over the planet, started, you know, perking people's ears and asking questions like, well, what is in it? Let's start looking at it. And at the same time, there was the two groups. They were called Grit and Gist. They were an American team and a German team that had gone to Greenland and had dug, you know, these crazy ice core samples miles deep into, you know, the center of the most deepest point of ice that they could kind of get to get isotope ratios from different things that they were seeing in the ice were comparable now to certain things that they were seeing in the black mat layer. So what this was an indication was, an event had occurred at a certain moment in time that they could now date based on these ratios, based on what they were seeing in the black mat layer. And what those ratios were saying is that two major things. One, what was there were these nanodiamonds, microsphericals, which were, you know, aggregate types of stones from quartz to granite that had been melted together or liquefied and then instantaneously quenched. So like if you were like working a horseshoe and you were heating it and bending it to shape and then, you know, you put it in the bucket and right, you know, to harden the steel. This material has all these indicative signs of incredible heat at post byproduct of, and then as I said, quenching. Now, what the nanodiamonds and a lot of these particles are indicating to scientists that are looking at is that this is the byproduct of a cosmological impact. There's no way that in any other way through normal processes that this kind of heat could be generated unless there was some kind of moment of ekpyrosis, which is, you know, intense heat by fire. Then you have the quenching of the material, which then ends up becoming water. So you have a catastrophic failing of an ice sheet system that then ties into, you know, the extirpation of hundreds of megafauna, including, you know, the mammoth, as we're starting to talk about. And then that leads us into, I know we're getting close to the end of the half hour, but leads us into this whole question of archaeology and the types of things that are being found that are related to that time frame. And then, you know, again, like, I know we're getting close to the half hour, but where the mythos of this sort of occurs and tied into Greek mythology and time frame schedules is sort of relative to sort of the subsidence of the Atlantic Ridge and what would be considered maybe the fabled story of the lost continent of Atlantis. So there, where mythos meets truth is the fact that the data and the telemetry are suggesting, yes, there was this catastrophic failing of the ice sheets. There was an incredible deluge. It drastically changed the face and cosmetics of the planet, as well as millions of things lost their lives, including vegetation and animals. And it is still so imprinted on the subconscious of humankind that that's even why we still look at it in myth today and are wondering, did that happen? What was that? You know.
Now, Ed, we need to take a break. We'll be back in about 3 minutes. And we're talking to Ed Roman, who is a award-winning singer-songwriter out of Canada. You're listening to Night Dreams Talk Radio. Check out our website. It's been updated today at www.nightdreamstalkradio.com. We will be right back.
What we are asking for from the government is full disclosure. We know what we're seeing, and there are
well as your spacecraft on the walls. It's a recurring theme. I've seen the same thing while walking late at night, and I know it's not a dream.
Stay safe, stay indoors, and listen to us.
You can advertise your business on Night Dreams Talk Radio, and you will be heard worldwide. Why not contact us at nightdreamstalkradio@gmail.com?
From the compound in beautiful Gig Harbor, Washington, Night Dreams Talk Radio presents your host, Gary Anderson.
And we are back with singer Ed Roman. You know, I think back all the times Joe Taylor, who has a museum, a fossil museum in Texas, has told us, you know, like, he's been all over the world gathering fossils. And from Texas to Canada to Africa to Brazil, what he said is, whatever happened, you go down a certain level when you're finding the remains of these prehistoric animals. And there was a layer of, well, where water came in. And it tells you that, well, all the landmass at one time was underwater at one point. What could have done it? Well, it could have been a volcano going off. But realistically, now this is only my point of view from me reading, maybe we got hit with a large asteroid, and that caused, well, what happened. I don't know how you feel about this, Ed, but that's one of the feelings I have.
Absolutely, because I think what it seems to be is sort of like a shotgun effect with the material. It's interesting that I remember listening to the beginning of the show, and you're like, you know, coming from that point in the Pleiades. Well, we're talking about, like, basically the constellation of Taurus, and that it coincidentally, maybe not so, but through the cycle of this sort of grand timing of things in terms of astronomy and mathematics, that the Taurid meteor stream is a meteor stream that is coming at us from the constellation of Taurus, from the Pleiades area. And it happens really identifiably so in late June and early July, and it's most intense in early October, November, as far as the 3rd of November, I believe it finishes. But regardless, it's most prevalent then. But the Taurid stream itself is a wide, flat band stream. It's more like a cosmological bit of material that got ripped apart, and as a result, it got stretched out over millions and billions of kilometers in space, whereas something more like Halley's hasn't been yet stripped completely or broken apart, so it's more defined in a singular thing, stripping its cosmological material. But the idea that this sort of moment, this what they identify as the Younger Dryas moment, seems to correlate on that mathematical equative level to that sort of time frame where a comet was coming into proximity to the heliosphere, which is Helios being the sun god from Greek mythology. The comet itself was stripped in a way or broken apart, and on its next circular orbit, it then had the opportunity to then, as I mentioned, a shotgun effect come over the course of a period of time. So it was probably a number of events, if not four, for sure, two major events that probably had sort of other cataclysmic after effects. If you go back and you think, remember Shoemaker-Levy 9 that, you know, ran into Jupiter? Yeah, it was like wild, and that we could So it broke apart, I believe, into what they call the pearled necklace, which was 21 separate immense pieces that, you know, eventually just pummeled Jupiter in this way over and over again over a period of time. And that's kind of probably what it had occurred with this cosmological material from the Taurid meteor stream. It was stripped, became a couple of pieces. We had two major impact ratios, but then over a gradual period of time, you know, we're looking at maybe 9,000 to 10,000 years, there were other smaller events that could be considered related to what that remnants of that material was. And now it's no longer as proximity related to us, but doesn't mean it doesn't have the timing to come back in some kind of a way. So the ice sheets themselves were hit by two sort of events that seem to begin in 13.6 BP. So when I'm saying BP, it's before present. A lot of sort of new diagnoses of time in the past are now related to before present as opposed to BC or AD. So this 13.6 would basically put it at, you know, 11,600, you know, is to where in terms of BC. So people can kind of get that frame of reference from of yesteryear of thinking about it in terms of time. So it appears that, like, that event drastically affected everything, including, as I mentioned, anybody that was living south of the ice margin. And that is not only in North America. I mean, we're thinking about a piece of material, ice, that is 2 miles thick, that stretches from as far as South Carolina in the eastern part, west to the northern parts of California, right, like, across the border into Canada, as far north as Alaska, coming way across to the top, connecting probably to Greenland, coming down the other side. I mean, and 2 miles thick. It's an incredible – and then you've got the divide that's there that they always call the Grand Divide, that they always, you know, figured the Clovis people or ancient people were using as a channel to hunt mammoth, you know, go back and forth, and that's who extirpated the mammoth, and that was the – which I don't believe just because of all this new data. But – point being is that those two sheets, the Laurentide sheet, which is closer to like Quebec and around the Hudson's Bay area, and the, what is the other one again? It is the Iso-Scandinavian sheet, which was more in Europe, and then you have the Cordier sheet that was would have been over the Rocky Mountains, and it would have created that corridor that would have been there. So the impacts suggest that they are repetitive, moving across the continent. And as a result, first of all, causing catastrophic melting. But then the byproduct is 1,000 years between those two events and major glacial bowl lakes that were formed as a result of the catastrophic melting and the heating. This is the other thing that's wild about the isotope ratios that we're looking at. Think about this, man. For 200,000 years, we have basically an unstable climate inside a glacial age. So what they're seeing inside of this vacillation of the isotope ratios is that the temperature margins are moving anywhere between 18 degrees in either direction every 5 to 10 years. So 18 degrees warmer all of a sudden, 5 years later, it's 18 degrees colder. And that happened for like a good portion of time. All of a sudden, after this event, we move from that era of Pleistocene to the Holocene era and to an interglacier age, which means we're getting glaciers, then they're departing. We're getting glaciers, and then they're departing. And that fluctuation hasn't had much of a vacillation for almost 10,500 years, other than about 2 degrees. So for almost 200,000 years, there's literally no stability. This event happens, then for 10,000 plus years, we have almost what you would consider complete harmony as far as stability with like climate, ocean, movement, all of these kinds of things that create the fecundity inside of what we now consider, you know, global sustainability in nature. So it's fascinating that this event, as apocryphal as it was also the very thing that has created a stable environment today in many ways.
Yeah, but Ed, don't you think the stability is not going to be there much longer? Because, like I mentioned, we have what's going on. And, you know, I had a geologist on here last week who is in denial of it. You know, he said, you know, well, these glaciers melting in Antarctica. It's like if you put an ice cube in a bucket of water, it's going to melt. It's not going to raise the level. He didn't take in consideration how tall some of these glaciers and all this stuff is in Antarctica. It's not sea level, like dropping an ice cube in it. I just read another article today that the sea level in the next year or two is going to go up at least 2 feet. The Doomsday Glacier in Antarctica, you know, they sent a submarine a couple weeks ago underneath it to investigate it because there's a volcano underneath it. They said that could go at any time. We're very unstable. So we could be going through another stage, what you're talking about, at any time. That's the scary part.
That's right. We're almost like in the weirdest of ways do. And I guess that's why where this ties into Greek mythology and the idea of, see, this is the thing. I mean, as much as, you know, whatever experience we've had in our educational process as to what we understand about Greek mythology, and some of it may be simplistic or more complicated, is that a lot of the stories themselves were, from what I can understand, not just mythos. It wasn't just myth. It was allegory, but it was tied into the idea of theatrics. So one of the things that's really interesting to point out inside of this, and it's the myth of Phaeton or the fall of Phaeton. So the idea is that, you know, the myth tells us that Phaeton goes to his father Helios, the sun god, and Helios hasn't seen his son in quite some time. And Helios says, oh, you know, father, it's so good to see you. And oh, my son, it's so good to see you. And, you know, what can I do? I will grant you any boon you wish, you know. And Phaeton says, well, let me take the chariot. You know, and the father says, well, no, you know, I can't let you do that because it's, you know, it's pretty difficult to drive the chariot, right? And, you know, Phaeton's like, well, you said anything I wanted. And so he says, okay. So Helios grants them the right to the chariot. And in a short time, as much as, you know, Phaeton wants to, you know, prove himself not only to himself but his father, he loses control. And the myth tells us that Phaeton, you know, flies into the lion's head. And after flying past and through the lion's head, he runs into the bull. And after running into the bull, he runs into his sister, who is the earth. And the earth yells, you know, cries out to her father, Helios, the sun god, you know, why have you given Phaeton, you know, the ability to ride the chariot? And he's driving it into me. It's destroying me. You know, and this cycle plays out over and over again in so many different myths from ancient culture. The myth of Phaeton is basically describing this concept of what the torrid meteor stream is doing. I mean, Helios represents the sun god, but cosmological stripping and losing the reins, when it's referring to Phaeton moving to the face of the lion, it's moving into the constellation of Leo. And as it's moving through the constellation of Leo in the sky and it's moving into the face of the bull, it's in Taurus. It's now coming from out of the face of the bull and crashing into his sister, who is the earth. This is a way for that form of culture to describe what it was through this theatrical system of story to say that this kind of thing occurs. Coincidentally, these stories are also passed, not just from generation to generation, but from culture to culture sometimes. So a lot of times people go, well, you know, Plato is the one who wrote the story. You know, it's an allegory for, you know, what could happen to us as a society. But they don't understand more about Plato and, you know, the Socratic form and where stories evolve from. And really this idea comes from the poet and lawgiver, Greek poet lawgiver Solon, who was exiled and was exiled to Egypt for a decade. And while he was there, he learned the story of Atlantis from the Egyptian priests who had detailed records who basically told, you know, Solon that, you know, your culture are just children in comparison to what has already happened to the world. And the earth itself has lived and died many times through the trials of water and fire. So Plato really, you know, or Solon really takes this story back to Greece, where it, through a couple of generations, ends up in the Socratic form, where he then Plato hears it to sort of articulate it in some kind of way in the two books of Timaeus and Critias. But coincidentally, not so much to me in that regard, where Plato is describing where the priests are saying the time frame exists, is collaterally so close to what we're talking about as an event that, you know, thinking about the ancient myth of what the Atlanteans were, what I mean, really looking at the diagnostics of it from an anthropological level, they were a formidable maritime culture that, you know, was probably, you know, at war with pre-Phoenicians, is what sort of the dialogue is dictating to us. And that there was an event that happened. And when you start looking at the description of the event, it's a cosmological impact that created, as I mentioned, first of all, this catastrophic flood. But this is where the geology part of all this kicks in, because it's, you know, we take for granted that we're on a ball, it's spinning around, and we've got a moon, and we're moving around a star, and this system of solar is inside of, you know, this wonderful timing mechanism of the Milky Way galaxy, which, you know, it's crazy to think that all of that is sort of happening. But the sphere that we are on is extremely elastic and viscous, despite that we have this, you know, bedrock and basalt and a magnetic core that's, you know, spinning, and its interaction with the poles and the way that it, you know, interfaces with our star protects us and all of these things. But we have to understand that when incredible masses of material are all of a sudden obliterated for a catastrophic reason, there has to be compensation. What is known as isostatic compensation is a big part of why we believe the eustacy, which is what happens in the seafloor as a result of mass change on the land, then giving compensation somewhere else. So it can be very widespread, and it can also be extremely focused. Now, what people don't realize, if we were to go right now up to James Bay, you know, and the bottom of Hudson's Bay, there are areas around there that you can still look at that are still rebounding after 13,600 years from the byproduct of the weight of the ice that is there. I think it's like 5 centimeters a year that the Earth is still rebounding. So it's kind of like the teeter-totter effect, where if you are going to lose mass somewhere, you got to give in another location. So where this now information starts to point is the Azores and the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, and this subduction of an incredible amount of not only the land mass that was there, but the fragmented bits of the byproduct of the event, because it would have created catastrophic, you know, seismological events that would occur, and ocean levels as a result of meltwater over a gradual period of time, but nonetheless, that probably changed up to 470 feet and literally changed the Gulf Stream. I mean, the Gulf Stream would have risen above the Azores Plateau, which would have given the Azores, or below the Azores Plateau, which would have made the Azores still very fertile and habitable, but you would have had an ice sheet that would have been over Great Britain, over the Great Channel, and into Europe. And that's what, you know, the Iso-Scandinavian sheet is telling us, that there was even a big portion of the channel that's there, the English Channel. If you look at it underneath the water, there are so many similarities to the geography that you see on land, like, you know, the Grand Coulee and the fjords that you see is the byproduct of intense meltwater. You see that in the British Channel, in the English Channel. That meant that prior to that, that was frozen, and as a result of catastrophic meltwater, it carved that way. So, and that event, and we're going back to Greek myth, that event is telling us that this is a reoccurring system of things. Even the idea that, wait, you know, the meteor itself destroyed the ice sheets and we got here because of it. Well, starting to look again, that the meteors themselves are actually what created the ice age. Like, you're prolific in your statement by saying, well, it could happen any moment. Well, yeah, I mean, there was just a little while ago a meteorite that came by that was immense, that we weren't expecting, and it had its own moon. And you know, we could be due for an impact like that. But coincidentally, where that part of mythos and legend comes from is that it seems to be coincidentally tied into this certain point of the torrid meteor stream. This is really why, even from an ancient cultural perspective, the Day of the Dead or the 31st or All Souls Day is so associated with October, because it is the quintessential height of the torrid meteor stream. And as I mentioned, it still may be something that's imprinted on the subconscious of people today, and why that myth and legends exists in a lot of places around the world that celebrate a Day of the Dead in October.
You're right.
You know, now, so
you're right. And what you're saying does make a lot of sense. But here's another thing a lot of people don't realize. As these ice sheets are melting in Antarctica, I just read a report a few days ago from NASA. The Earth is tilting on its axis because of the melting glaciers in Antarctica. But there's still people out there, it's not happening. I mean, we got a lot of events it's going on. You talk about a comet hitting the Earth at one point. We don't even know from day to day if we're going to get hit, because we don't spend the money where we need to for research. And that's the scary part.
But that's primarily why the information to me is fascinating. To others, it may not be. It may be dry or whatever. And that's fine. But that's, I guess, where the people that I have paid close attention to are saying, well, then that does give us the option to understand the cycle, to be better able to protect ourselves or move the comet or whatever it is that we need to do. I mean, any way you look at it, if we've been repeating this over and over again for who knows how many millennia, I think it's like we're well aware we need to be far more cosmological as a group of people. Like, I mean, we only have a certain amount of habitability on the sphere and resources in order to do that. We need to figure out a different way to start inhabiting other parts of the universe, own solar system. Yeah,
we need to. And it makes sense about us getting slammed by a comet. I don't think a big asteroid could have done as much as a comet would have done to us. But here's the thing right now. If you look at the mammoths, they said, oh, well, we got hit by a comet, we got hit by an asteroid. But when you really look at it, instantaneously, within a matter of an hour or two, the whole planet, either these mammoths were frozen to death or they were baked to death instantly, depending on what part of the planet when this hit.
I can call you dude because you're my buddy. You're completely right, because the archaeological evidence, I mean, it's staggering. Like, okay, there was a mammoth, like a tusk hunter, and he was in Siberia, and he was asking, you know, I'm looking for locations to hunt. I want to dig some stuff up and blah, blah, blah. This is like around 1910. And they had said, there's this lake, you know, go check out the lake. There's a little island on the lake, and it's littered with mammoth tusks. So he goes out there and figures out he's going to make his score. And he does. And more than that, while digging around on the island looking for more tusks, he starts to realize in short order that the entire island, this little island in the middle of the lake, is all mammoth bones. It's actually been filled in by, you know, natural materials over a period of time, and whatever the permafrost as it's receded, and it's now actually, you know, alpinic again. It's got like an alpine environment. The entire island itself is basically mammoth bones. So hundreds of, you know, mammoths are all washed into one place with broken femur bones. I mean, the Varikovska mammoth that they found, that they dug out of the permafrost, was still so well intact that the flesh on it would have considered to be edible because of the way it was flash frozen. And that when they had left the animal, the baby elephant that they had dug out, there's a couple crazy things. One, the wolves in short order started to make, you know, time on the skull. And there was things that they noticed. One of which was its rear haunches, it had fallen backwards. In its position, its two back femurs were broken, like snapped, like it had been thrown to the ground. The other thing is, as crazy as it sounds, it had an erection. Okay, and usually that's the byproduct of suffocation.
Right.
Now, they then did it, you know, an autopsy basically on the fish, necropsy, and or in the fish on the mammoth, and they realized that there's still buttercups, leaves, the sedges, the things that it was eating.
It wasn't even digested.
Not even. And it was preserved. So coincidentally, they decided, let's go ask some questions about this. And the inventor of Perkins Food flash freezing in the United States, who developed the flash freezing process, was actually called in to ask a bunch of questions about flash freezing. Like, how could this be done? And what could this take? He said, if you wanted to, the size of this animal, with how it's been preserved, with what's in its stomach, it would take less than 10 hours. That means this animal was frozen in 10 hours. Solid, its bones were broken, it was literally held in position, and then flash frozen. So whatever the byproduct of that event, and again, timing and the time frame of certain things, which are alluding to, was it a cosmological impact, which basically, put the poor boy down, right? And places in Georgia now that they're finding as well, too, where, again, there's these levels and sluices of mammal bones, like mammoths, that they're like, well, how did all this wash here? Some of the ones that they've found, like you said, burnt, the feet are intact. The bones, you can see that there's still calcium. But as you work your way up the skeletal remains of the animal, the top half are all burnt. So if we go back and think about the moment of ekpyrosis, which is like igniting of the atmosphere, if an animal is running and you have this cosmological impact that all of a sudden ignites the atmosphere, and they're running and burning, horrific as it may be, then all of a sudden there's catastrophic melting that is washing them like a bunch of leaves down a creek. There's not going to be much left of anything after that kind of melting, including if you think about the geological material that is carved. Some of the rocks and stones and the byproducts of these floods and materials, I mean, we're talking about, glacial erratics that are the size of like small apartment buildings. And these glaciers moved in this meltwater, carrying these stones. And in Utah or somewhere like that, and wherever.
Right.
And you're like, where did this huge stone come from? Like, it's just in the middle of nowhere, And it'll be a glacial erratic, especially depending on its form, the way that it looks, its shape, certain things like that. But quite often, you're like, well, how did it get here? That's the result of it being moved an incredible distance through meltwater, ending up where it was after the meltwater recedes, and it has no time. It has now time to melt, and over a period of time, eventually the boulder is released, and it's left there as a part of the geology. And and you can see even after looking at the material that the rocks are made of, this came from 300 miles away.
No, yeah.
This came from 1,000 miles away. So the mammoth and any megafauna, including saber-toothed cats, the mega bears, all of that was like gone, like almost instantaneously. And it's what's crazy is that the prosaic explanation for me, which I've always been taught, was like the Clovis people were part of the extirpation of the mammoth. They're the ones that brought the mammoth to extinction.
Now
there's no way when you look at the math. And how many mammoths there probably were in comparison to the amount of people or the size. James and I were talking earlier today, like the full size mammoth would stand 14 to 16 feet at the shoulder.
Oh, yeah.
Like
now, hey, Ed, we got to take our can you go for another half an hour? I can if you can.
Yeah, for sure, man.
OK, let's take this break. This break's about 4 minutes long. We'll be back with Ed Roman. We're talking about prehistoric days. What happened to the Earth? Could it happen again? And when we come back, I'm going to talk a little bit like what some of the Joe Taylor has talked about at the beginning after the break of what he thinks happened, after what this hit of the Earth, what it created afterwards. We'll be back. You're listening to Night Dreams Talk Radio.
Living in the strangest of times on my hill, watching while the city's rise from the collapse that we left when the sun beat it down.
Have a paranormal story you want to share on Night Dreams Talk Radio? You could be a guest. Email us at nightdreamstalkradio@gmail.com.
Good evening, or morning, depending on your time zone. From the Pacific to the Atlantic to you worldwide, get yourself a cup of Java and find a comfy, easy chair. And get ready for Gary and his guest on Night Dreams Talk Radio, After Dark. And now, here's Gary.
And here I am with Ed Roman, a singer out of Canada. He is also a songwriter and a performer, and great music. You should check him out. Now, one thing I will say, Joe Taylor has been on our show numerous times. Again, he actually goes and looks for dinosaur mammoth bones. He reconstructs them for museums. He also has his museum. And here's what he has said. Doesn't make a difference where you go, from Texas to the deserts to New Zealand to Africa. You dig down in certain areas, you find mammoth bones. And then there's a layer that looked like it was mud above it, which only could come if it was submerged in water. And it is really interesting. So again, like I said, whatever happened, it happened really fast. I mean, when you talk about mammoths with buttercups and its intestines not even digested, that means instant death. And like Ed was mentioning, bones broken. So from the impact, just think about, depending on how big this was, it would be like a nuclear bomb going off in your neighborhood. That is the type of destruction to Earth. And you really think about what is going on now. We have, like I mentioned so many times, I feel like I'm preaching to the choir here. You have the water coming from the equator, going up to the Caribbean, up to the UK, and it's slowing down. Now, some people are in denial. They say, that's not happening. But when that stops, well, part of the world is going to go into an ice age really quick. If we get hit by an asteroid or a comet, again, here back a couple weeks ago, think about this, 1,300 miles. If you got in your car and you went on a trip from like Seattle to L.A. or to San Francisco, that type of distance, an asteroid, a huge one, came flying by our Earth by only 1,300 miles from our planet. That is scary when you think about it. What do you think about that, Ed?
I mean, I'll count your lucky stars, as they say, right, Gary?
Well, I'm just hoping the next time it comes around, if it does, it doesn't slam into us.
That's just it. I mean, I think that's what I was saying before, and I guess what I'm learning is the understanding the timing of it, you know, that there could be something more grand to it in that way, and observing it gives us more insight to be able to, you know, whatever it might be. Like, I mean, I've heard people talking about some kind of a device that would push it just enough to take it out of minutes and seconds of our proximity. It is a scary thought, but I guess that's, you know, a part of the consequence of the cycle. It seems to be that, you know, with so many things, the circle of life, as it were, that there has to be this change.
Well, there got to be something, because even NASA is talking about they want to experiment on a couple asteroids. One is they figure, well, they can hit it with a nuclear, enough nuclear that it would cause it to change its orbit. Now, again, I hope they're accurate when they figure out their calculations. Then there's another group of scientists, what happens if it breaks up? And then instead of having one huge asteroid or a comet, we're going to get hit with thousands of pieces. It could take out the planet that way. And people don't realize a comet consists of basically frozen ice.
Right. And that's the important thing to realize is when those comets come from certain places. So the Oort cloud is going to produce more icy, gaseous type cosmological material. And the Kuiper belt is going to be producing those big metal ones that are scary and big and strong and intense. But as you mentioned, that, you know, blowing something up could fragment it. You know, that could be to our benefit and our detriment. To our benefit in a sense that if it does become smaller material, and depending on its trajectory, especially if it's oblique, so it's coming in on an angle, it'll burn up. And has the potential to burn up, but you're still going to end up with events that are like what happened in Russia with Tunguska, that leveled, you know, 240 kilometers, square kilometers of forest.
Gone.
And killed animals. And it was witnessed, you know, over the course of 16 kilometers as different, you know, stages of what it was doing as it came in. Now, if it came in on a more direct trajectory, its impact may not have had that stripping, you know, ability on an oblique to go, no, it's just bang. It's like the hammer effect. And it could, you know, where we sit today would have been a very drastic time frame because that's 1908. It could have taken a century for a product like that hitting the Earth just for the environment to recover. I mean, this is what's really interesting about following those records in whether they be dendrochronology, looking at the tree ring science behind these time frames, as well as those ice core samples, is that they're saying, you know, there are events that coincide with historical events that you cannot help but go, wait a minute. Like, so around the 530s, like the Tintagel and the Arthurian legends, you know, the whole Arthurian legend is the fact that, you know, the kingdom is dying, the king is suffering, and they need to find the grail in order to restore the land to, you know, prosperity again. And really, that era sort of indicates that through those, looking at those reports, Well, something happened then that created almost a stop in tree growth for 10 years. The same thing happened in the late 1300s where all the, you know, cathedral building, like there's this fluctuation. That's what you can also see is that on an anthropological level where you have an increase in population, the mortality ratios change. So you're living longer. People are eating better because there's that space in between those events. But then like, you know, what happened, the cathedrals started being built, like, you know, 13 to 20 formidable cathedrals in Europe. And then all of a sudden, the builders just stopped. They just put their tools down and left, like for like a decade. And again, when you start looking at the correlation between the material and the time frame, you go, well, there's a chance by what we're looking at through the ratios, the isotopes, that something happened again.
Oh, yeah.
And people forget. I think people forget that, like, when my great-grandfathers were alive, that was the ending of the Little Ice Age, which was like the 1850s. So the actual ice sheets, even in Europe, were so much further south than they are today that even environmentally, things could be considered different. And you know, before you were also bringing up, like, the environment and topics of the environment and change and the water levels and ocean levels. As much as there might be a debate on either side of the fence about what it is in the general population of thinking about it and our conversations about it, there aren't too many environmentalists that don't disagree that, you know, that the climate isn't changing. It is vastly more dynamic than we had understood before. And really, we are infants in our understanding of what the climate is, what its potential is, how drastically and how quickly it can change. Like I mentioned, going from glacial to interglacial, and you know, it all can happen in the snap of a finger. It's such a precious space that we live in that has been protected by, I have coincidence for 10,000 plus years. I mean, it's pretty scary. Like you said, what do you think about all that stuff floating around out there? I mean, I wake up every day and I thank God nothing has happened
yet.
You know, but I don't go to bed every night worrying about it either, because I know that if the cycle needs to be there, it's bigger than me.
it is. And you think about, like, again, people are in denial about many ice ages or ice ages. The last mini ice age or last ice age, Seattle was under 1600 feet of ice. That's a lot. 1600 feet is a lot of ice. But if you could drive 60 miles away from it, the temperature was in the 60s. So it's really weird how it affects certain areas. What I'm concerned right now, when you think about it, the Earth is tilting on its axis. That's going to create something. Again, you know, the seawater rising. People, okay, well, it's rising a little bit. They don't realize. If you read the scientific journals, like in North Carolina and a few other states, as the sea level is rising, it doesn't take much. The groundwater gets contaminated with salt water. Now the forests, you know, around the ocean, you know, inland, are dying. And what they have found, the reason why they're dying, is the groundwater is contaminated with salt water. So we have all these little cycles going on. So I just would like to have been there when these prehistoric animals, the day before all this happened, and I would love to have been there the day after it happened, just to see what happened. Because it had to be something, even for that. You think if we got hit by a comet or a huge asteroid, and it went into the ocean, and it caused a huge wave to come inland and flooded the Earth. Again, you know, it's so interesting what happened. I mean, and you look at all these digs of these prehistoric animal bones, you're right. They're finding what we just said. Part of the bones are burnt. So whatever happened, it happened so freaking fast, my friend.
Oh, incredibly. That's why I think it was dismissed for so many years and people were labeled the way that they were, because gradualism says, well, that's not the case. I mean, erosion works this way. You know, the Darwinistic process of evolution works this way. And that's also an interesting thing. I mean, for 200,000 years, you know, we've looked the way that we've looked. If you took somebody from, you know, 175,000 years ago and cleaned them up and, you know, put modern day clothes on them on a you know, skeletal system, cosmetics and things like, they wouldn't be that much different. There is this still questionable jump in even our structure, you know, and what happened and why, you know, we had a bigger, more formidable cranial capacity and all of these kinds of things that gave us, you know, forward thinking, that sort of cerebral front brain, all of that is still highly questionable. And sort of like with gradualism, this is where you say it happens so fast. You can't put that measure on it. You can't put that scale on it and look back and go, there are things like, I mean, in today, in modern day Norway and Sweden and places like that, when you have a glacial bull lake, it's known as, when it collapses and fails, it's called a jökulsá. And basically all the water is flooding and you have this sort of catastrophic flood. And that is, you can extrapolate now today and say, well, yes, this is how it functions. But its size and variance, again, scale and variance, may not be obtainable because we're still trying to extrapolate from zero to backwards to 100. As opposed to realizing we may not have that ratio to look at. It may be 100 right away. And an event like that would create something like that. The two glacial lakes that I'm more familiar with, Glacial Lake Agassiz and Glacial Lake Missoula, which is closer out to you guys, which is the big Missoula flood. Those glacial lakes, I mean, Agassiz was the size of Saskatchewan, Ontario, part of Quebec, and Manitoba. And, you know, icebergs floating in it and deep, 1,000-plus feet deep of water that, you know, catastrophically failed, like Lake Missoula or Lake Agassiz or Missoula, excuse me. And when you start looking at the configuration of the Great Lakes, the Drumlin Fields in New York State, the Finger Lakes in New York State, the 8 feet of what is known as loess topsoil that's like in Arkansas and Illinois, that material is washed material coming from Canada, catastrophically being moved incredible distances and deposited. So if material rocks the size of houses, glaciers and things are melting, and all that large material on an epic scale is what, like you said, I would have loved to have been there to see the look on the mammoths' faces, because there's no way anything would have been saved in that process. And I guess that's why it's become part of that mythological connection to the ancient past as far as storytelling and mythos, is that it seems to be synonymous everywhere. And where I think people have also been blindsided is because gradualistic theory says, well, it could have happened in different places over different periods of time. And that's true. And it's still happening today, like the tsunami in Japan or the jökulsá that I mentioned, or anything that we see that's catastrophic on that level today. But again, what's interesting is that it's parallel. The oldest stories that we have, they can vary. There's, you know, the antagonist and protagonist. There's the man versus man, man versus nature, man versus himself. There's all these other aspects to that we can see. But what seems to be most parallel and synonymous across the globe is that story, the epic story of that flood. And you know, during the commercial, and we were talking before we went to commercial, you know, again, there are even incidents today where you go, wait a minute, the coincidence behind what this represents, it ties into this paying attention to this, you know, cosmological event. So like the Chicago fire in more modern times, which people are familiar with, you know, there's correlations to certain things that you go, well, that's, how is that possible? So as everybody knows, the Chicago fire, you know, was it Mrs. Leary's cow, you know, and that's what started. There's still questions being asked. And so that event, October 8th, happens at 9 p.m., right? The Great Chicago Fire.
Right.
Well, what people don't look at is the Peshtigo incident, which was on the peninsula in Lake Michigan, which on October 8th at 9 p.m. spontaneously combusted. The atmosphere, everything. People were ignited on fire, buildings incinerated, livestock, forests completely devastated. They don't talk about Peshtigo because, you know, Chicago was Chicago. But you look at those two areas, it looks like a bomb went off, like a nuclear bomb went off. And the weird anomalies, paranormal anomalies that exist even inside of that. The Peshtigo incident, half of the townspeople was sitting at about 3,000 townspeople at the time of that event. For no reason, a couple of days before, started seeing figures, you know, this light being that, you know, they even went, you know, later built a small chapel dedicated to this figure that approached this person. And the person said, well, you know, on the day after tomorrow, you should tell everybody to go walk into the water up to their heads because something's going to happen. So they do. Half the town people go, whatever, you're crazy. And the other half with a priest go and like walk into the water. And this ekpyrosis moment where everything, as I mentioned, including the atmosphere, is literally ignited. And the priest's account of the event is like, you know, he's seeing these fireballs exploding in the sky and igniting things on the ground on fire and things that his description trying to describe, I can't believe what I'm seeing. Apocalypse, you know, it comes to his mind in terms of what it is. But the descriptions of certain things are also very characteristic to other events that are almost unexplainable that, you know, go back in time with other cultures. So there's this relationship to how it functions. So October 8th and the Great Fire of Miramichi, October 8th, 9 p.m. All those events are occurring during the torrid meteor stream. When the torrid meteor stream is beginning, and eventually it ends, as I mentioned, around the 3rd of November. So what we're also learning about, you know, like you said, totally true, Gary, like cosmological material is coming in. Is it ice? Is it metal? Where is it coming from? Well, the heliosphere, as something is passing within its proximity, as much as, you know, it gives us our life and our planet and the way it's reacting is protecting us through the magnetic core, it also has the potential of stripping cosmological material, no different than a comet gets stripped. As we watch it pass, that tail is tons of material being pulled off of it as a result of it doing what it's doing. That the Peshtigo incident and the Miramichi fire and the Chicago fire and other moments in time seem to be related to the comet being stripped, gaseous materials somehow grounding themselves on the ground and becoming ignited. Because even prior to the event, people were like smelling gas in the forest and in basements where there wasn't gas, you know, and noticing these strange things that they couldn't chalk up to, well, it's, you know, a gas pipe, it's this, it's that. They could never really figure out what it was. But cosmological material has that potential. Even on an electromagnetic level, it could be reacting with its deposition in the sun and the earth and the way that it's moving between the two, almost like a static charge with a balloon. So, you know, the Belle Island incident and other discharge moments that we've had that, you know, can be considered as like, what happened there? You know, what was that huge electric ball that discharged itself on the coast? That are all could be highly related to things that are on that level. So, like, I even in modern times, without even going back into the past 13,600 years ago, we could go, wow, you know, that incident in Russia was an event.
Oh,
the stuff
was.
That happened in Peshtigo and in Chicago were probably an event. You know,
and is this a matter of time before we have another event? Now, one of the listeners had a question for you, and the question was, have you ever spoken with any natives up north on what they're reporting
about this?
Yeah, I guess that's what that was the question she asked.
Yeah, well, that, yeah, interestingly enough, that's where I started to find more validity. Was stories of Aboriginal cultures that were telling those stories that were so close to, one of them was even documented by Thomas Jefferson, where the story goes that, I can't remember the name of the archetype again, but basically was told by the god that they were going to release a lightning bolt upon the earth, and that man had forgotten about the higher time, and even animals had forgotten about the higher time. And the story was talking about them referring to mammoths, these large beasts that had grown in such number that they were even blotting out the sun.
Well, I got to jump in here. I got to jump in to something we didn't discuss. And here's what also that Joe Taylor explained to me. Back in the mammoth period, the oxygen content of this earth was way higher. So if any asteroid or a huge comet came in and ignited before it blew up, because that's what it's going to do, the oxygen content was more that would have caused a lot larger explosion.
It could be, because at that moment in time, if the planet was colder, the oceans act as a carbon sink. So when it's colder, they're going to hold in more carbon dioxide and there'll be a higher oxygen environment. When it's warmer, they release the carbon, so you have a higher amount of carbon in the atmosphere. But that's, yeah, I mean, that's, you know, that's a good point. Like, and what ignites it or how it happens, you know, that on that level, if we're talking Peshtigo or Chicago, it could be anybody's guess. Is it a more enriched environment? Is it a lamp? I mean, with that kind of material coming into the atmosphere, it's anybody's guess. But Joe sounds like a really interesting character, because, you know, like, I like hearing that from people that are out in the field, because I've even heard argument from those that have questioned those digs by going, well, wait a minute, how did these 150 mammoths just wash up? And they're like, well, no, this was a gradual deposition.
Well, you know, but here's
what. Can't be a gradual deposition, because that would imply then that the decay would have to happen in different stages, and this deposition indicates that all this occurred at once. It can't be gradual.
That's right, because, you know, again, Joe Taylor, in Texas, for example, there was an area of camel, you know, skulls and certain parts of the remains of camels, and he said it was this one area, it was everywhere. They weren't washed up, they were there. And then the water came in with a layer of, you know, dirt, mud, and buried them. It's very interesting. And even in Canada, there was camels. So that's what our climate was like when all this was going on. And, you know, our time is up. I need to have you, your agent or whatever, get a hold of us. We should have you on with Joe Taylor.
I would love that. That would be so awesome. I love that. That'd be great. Let's do it. I'm in.
Well, let's do that. Hey, James, jump in here. Isn't Joe Taylor scheduled to come on here in the near future?
He is. I'll have to look up, but I believe it's in June sometime.
Perfect.
Actually. June.
Yeah. So I'll have my producer get a hold of you. Let's do it. I think we can go 2 hours and talk about this nonstop. Again,
yes, man.
Again, if people want to find you, do you have a website where they can find you?
EdRoman.net. Everything is there, social networking buttons, all the indications to how to get to the new singles, the new album, all of that stuff. I just got to say, I've been telling people all week about how excited I am to be on the show because of this topic, and I just find it so electrifying and bringing so many things together. So thank you for giving that opportunity to happen tonight, man.
Well, I enjoyed having you on because it's refreshing. I tell you what, we talk a lot about the paranormal, and it's nice to get on a different subject. Hopefully, we haven't scared anybody tonight. But again, you have to look at Earth changes are going on. Again, NASA said the Earth is tilting more and more as these glaciers in Antarctica are melting. Again, the sea level is rising. We got a volcano in, was it Iceland or somewhere, that could take out part of the world. We got another volcano. We got one here in the United States in Yellowstone. Again, we got a lot of things. What we need to do is get Bruce Willis out of and back into a spacesuit and maybe save the Earth down the future. What do you think?
Well, yeah, or just like, let's send it whatever we need to whatever's coming in and give it a nice nudge.
I will say this. Have you ever heard of a doctor, Richard Allen Miller?
I have. The name totally rings a bell. Subject, topic.
Okay, well, he was a science advisory for Richard Nixon at the White House. He trained, right. He came up with training manuals for the Navy SEALs in the 60s. He holds a whole bunch of PhDs. He's 77 years old. He's still under contract with the military to design and location of bunkers. A lot of people don't realize it. Our government is building massive bunkers.
Big seed bunker up north is a big talk, and I've seen it everywhere from social media to mainstay media, and, you know, seed storage and how they're doing it, and it's crazy.
Well, something is going on. I mean, when you think about it, because, like, the last time he's coming on our show, I think, tomorrow again, and he has something he wants to tell the listeners. It's scary when you listen to this guy, because it's not all about dooms, but he also tries to tell people how to prep to be one of the survivors. But something, when you think about it, they're building these underground bunkers like mad. And then the rich people are building them like mad. Maybe something is up that we don't know about.
What happened in the Denver airport in the 90s? I mean, I ask anybody that's been through the Denver airport, like, they excavated how many acres, and it only has a footprint of 3, and at how many levels deep, and you're not going to store baggage in a space that big underground. I mean, there's some strange stuff going on at the Denver airport, brother.
Yeah, maybe it's earth changes. I don't know. Everybody, check out Ed Roman's website. You'll like his music. It's fantastic. He's a very interesting person. We had him on the show before, you know, talking about his encounter of a Bigfoot in the past. Again, I want to thank you so much, Ed, for coming on the show here tonight.
Gary, thank you, and I hope you're feeling better, and I'm really looking forward to being on the show with Joe in the future.
I will make that happen. Okay, my friend, you take care.
Thank you. Thanks, bye. James, too. Bye-bye, sir.
Well, tomorrow, again, we have, guess what? We have Dr. Richard Allen Miller. He got a hold of me a couple weeks ago and said, hey, guess what? I need to talk to your listeners. And he said he had something very important to say. I don't know, but this guy has so many PhDs. Again, he worked for the Richard Nixon administration as a advisor to the White House science. He is very noted for training the military survival, and he'll be on the show. And I don't know what he's going to talk about tomorrow, but it's going to be very interesting. So don't miss tomorrow's show. Everybody out there, you have a good one. We will catch you later. And please, stay out of trouble.
Old man DeBoer lived